Now, some things are very important and also very emotional. And I don't think there's anything as important and as emotional in the diamond industry like this issue of human rights. And, you know, when you're dealing with ethics, sometimes there is no one way, because you're constantly confronting, maybe we should have 700,000 people in Surat have jobs. What if we don't know if there are human rights abuses in Zimbabwe? What if we do know? So one of the things we did was to come out with this little discussion sheet. Now, this was created last night. The speakers aren't going to directly address this. My hope is to have three speakers up here, cover us for about an hour and a half, and then have an opportunity to discuss some of these issues, which are sample ethical questions, so it's not just a theoretical discussion. The speakers that we're going to have are really, really good people, and they're experts in different areas. The person coming up right now is the head of the Program for Business and Human Rights, and correct me if I'm wrong on these things, but I understand what they do is they collect credible reports of human rights abuses involving business around the world. They publish the information in a way where a company cannot avoid taking responsibility for the unintended, sometimes intended, but mostly unintended consequences of their actions. So if a business is doing something, and as a result of what they're doing, there are human rights abuses or other serious problems, I would understand that this organization would do it. So Annabelle's prepared a presentation for us. It's Annabelle Short. She's head of the program, Business and Human Rights Resource Center. And thank you for being here. And here is Annabelle Short. Hey.
Hi, everybody. So in the next half hour or so, I'm going to first of all talk about what I mean, what people mean when they say human rights. Then a brief bit about our organization and how it works, followed by some human rights issues beyond conflict diamonds related to the diamond sector, and a few ideas about looking forwards. So human rights, as I'm sure most of you know, are enshrined initially in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was adopted in 1948, and then the various human rights documents that stemmed out of that, covenants on civil and political rights, social, economic, and cultural rights, and more specific ones on migrant workers, etc. And they cover the full range, in terms of business and human rights, the full range of companies' impacts on society. So there's issues like workplace health and safety. You know, often I think there's a perception that only certain industries have human rights responsibilities, but for an issue like workplace health and safety, that covers a lot of industries. Security issues, including in conflict zones, but not only. Workplace discrimination, which again is an issue that's relevant to a lot of sectors. Access to life-saving medicines, which is a huge issue for the pharmaceutical sector, obviously, but also, you know, as we'll see, for mining companies as well and others working in areas with illnesses like HIV/AIDS. Indigenous people's rights. Poverty and development, including access to water, which is now pretty much recognized as a human right. And environmental damage impacting the right to health. So why see all of these issues as human rights issues rather than just, you know, components of corporate responsibility? One is, as the slides previously showed, they cover a very wide spectrum. So for companies interested in looking at the whole range of its impacts on society, a human rights framework is a very good place to start. They're also internationally accepted standards. They're universal. Sometimes what you hear is arguments, you know, human rights are actually a Western concept and we should respect different cultures and approaches. And there's various responses to that, including the fact that in 1993, 171 governments from all regions of the world signed the Vienna Declaration, in which they all reaffirmed the fact that human rights are universal. Often you also find that the people who are making the arguments about cultural relativism would not necessarily be the people who are being abused. So if you ask a woman in Saudi Arabia what she feels about discrimination, for example, she would recognize the international value of those standards. Their bottom-up is sort of one way our organization looks at them. So whereas corporate responsibility approaches can often involve the company coming, you know, from headquarters or elsewhere, looking at its impacts on society and deciding which issues to prioritize, with a human rights approach, it's very much looking at the actual people throughout a company's operations who are impacted. As I'm sure everybody knows there are increasing expectations for companies to respect human rights. And I should have said right at the beginning, actually, I mean, the mere fact that the whole afternoon session this afternoon is on human rights is wonderful to see, and probably wouldn't have been the case to have seen, you know, diamond industry engaged so much on these issues 10 years ago. So there's increasing expectations from NGOs, from consumers, but also from investors. While that used to be mainly social investors, increasingly we're seeing mainstream investors interested in human rights issues or social environmental impacts of companies. For example, Bloomberg, it was interesting, just a few months ago, launched a social and environmental component of its financial terminals that are used by investors all around the world, recognizing that that's important information for investors to know. And there's a clear business case, whether it's financial in terms of the risks of a project being delayed because of protests, reputational factors, the risk of lawsuits from organizations saying that a company has abused human rights, but also in a positive sense in terms of attracting and retaining employees who increasingly are keen to work for companies that don't have poor human rights records. So a little bit on our organization, Business and Human Rights Resource Center. It was founded in 2002. And as the banner on our website says, tracking the positive and negative impacts of over 5,100 companies worldwide. So we're definitely not coming from either a pro-business or an anti-business stance. We're coming from a human rights perspective, saying companies can do a great deal to contribute to human rights. We recognize that. We highlight positive steps by companies. There are also concerns raised. We highlight those. And as you'll see, we invite companies to respond to allegations. Focus is on individual companies. You can go to the site, and there are currently about 5,000. You can click on the company section, including several diamond companies that are on the website, and look at the latest news and reports about their human rights record. That's just a smorgasbord of some of the companies on the site. And as you'll see, we're trying to shine a spotlight just as much on under-the-radar companies, non-Western companies, smaller companies, as well as the big brand names. But we're not just focusing on the big brand names. The website's updated each hour, 1.5 million hits per month. And our model is very much to have regional researchers. So we have offices in the UK and New York. But we also have regional researchers on the basis they're much better placed to build contacts with local companies, local NGOs. Currently, they're in India, Senegal, South Africa, and Ukraine, soon to be also Hong Kong, and obviously plans for other regions as well. Just as a restaurant guide, you would immediately question its impartiality if it was funded by restaurants, and we can't accept money from corporations or corporate foundations. So we're funded by foundations such as, you know, Ford Foundation, Sigrid Rousing Trust in the UK, increasingly by governments and by individuals as well. And as I'll describe in a later case relating to the diamond industry, we have a process whereby each week we send out the top stories on business and human rights to 10,000 people around the world. But if we receive from an NGO, from a journalist, a story raising concerns about a company in which the company hasn't addressed those concerns or responded, first we go to the company headquarters and say, we're sending this out next week, but do you want to include your response alongside? Which ensures that, one, they're aware of the concerns, which might not always be the case. They've had an opportunity to put their side of the story out there. Our coverage is balanced. And ideally, that'll then lead to dialogue between the organization raising the concern, the company itself, and remediatory steps, if necessary. So a few of the human rights issues as they relate specifically to the diamond sector. The one that I know everyone in this room will be very familiar with is the conflict diamonds one, so I thought I would put that up there first, how in the 1990s, revenue from diamonds going particularly to rebel groups in countries like Angola and Liberia and Sierra Leone were fueling very brutal conflicts. But that then led to the development of the Kimberley process, which aimed to cut off those sources of revenues to rebel groups and did a huge amount to reduce diamonds' direct contribution to conflict. I think people say there's only about 1% of diamonds internationally circulating now are conflict diamonds, as it were, so it's a much smaller proportion than it used to be. But one of the big challenges is that we still don't know exactly what that 1% is in terms of tracing diamonds to their origin, and that'll come up sort of further in the presentation as well. Also, recent cases that have come to light that have thrown into question, you know, how effective the Kimberley process is. I'm sure it was mentioned this morning at some point, but the case of the Marange diamond fields in Zimbabwe, where in 2008, according to Human Rights Watch, 200 people were killed when the military moved in to take over the mine. And that since then, people have been being made to work, forced to work, often at gunpoint. So really horrendous abuses going on there. But the Kimberley process decided after a sort of period of deliberations that sourcing could resume again from that mine. I know that Michael's presentation later is going to go and look into various ways in which Kimberley can be reformed or people can move beyond Kimberley in terms of certifying the sources of diamonds. Another is Indigenous people's rights. So one case recently is the case of Bazara and Bagaladi Bushman communities in Botswana. When the UN Special Rapporteur for Indigenous Peoples said recently Indigenous peoples who've returned to the Central Kalahari Game Reserve face harsh and dangerous conditions due to a lack of access to water, a situation that could easily be remediated by reactivating the boreholes in the reserve. The government's position that habitation of the reserve by the Bushmen is incompatible with the reserve's conservation objectives appears to be inconsistent with its decision to permit Gem Diamonds GOP Exploration Company conducting mining operations within the reserve. So that's just sort of one example of the diamond industry potentially impacting on Indigenous communities. HIV/AIDS is another major issue. So this is a website called the Human Rights and Business Dilemmas Forum, organized by, hosted by the UN Global Compact, which many of you may know is a voluntary initiative that companies sign up to, committing to certain human rights, labor rights, and environmental principles. And on this Dilemmas Forum, companies actually discuss the real challenges and difficulties they have in addressing difficult human rights issues. So this is a dilemma that was posted by De Beers about its operations in Botswana, Namibia, and South Africa. And they say they're operating in countries where, in Botswana, for example, the rate of HIV/AIDS infection is over 23%. In Namibia, it's 15%. In South Africa, it's 18%. So very, very high rates of infection of HIV/AIDS. And what they've decided is to take a vision of zeros approach, which means zero new HIV infections in employees or partners, zero babies born with HIV/AIDS from mothers who fall within their treatment programs, and zero deaths from HIV/AIDS as employees and partners access the treatment programs. And they go on to discuss the sort of difficult ethical dilemmas that they face doing that in terms of their decision to expand treatment not only to their workers and partners, but also to members of the local communities, and where do you draw the line in terms of providing that treatment. Also, you know, balancing the need for treatment and the need to have a healthy workforce with the costs that imposes on their business, and also issues of discrimination, so making sure that people who are suffering from HIV/AIDS aren't discriminated against, or also people aren't wary about being tested for HIV/AIDS. A lot of you may also have heard about the case of artisanal miners working all the way around the world. One particular case is in Kwanga region in northeast Angola, where you have a situation where the artisanal miners are often, they've migrated from outside Angola, and they're often forcibly removed by the military. Also, civilians who are living in the vicinity of diamond concessions have been subjected to some pretty horrendous abuses, including beatings and killings. So by the military, also by private security firms who are working for the diamond companies. So as I said, our organization seeks responses from companies. And when, in 2007, I think it was, the Angolan human rights activist Rafael Marquez did a big report on this, he named five of the companies that were operating at the time there. I think that Lazar Kaplan has since moved out of the area. But what we did is we went to those five companies and we said, you know, next week we plan to include this report saying that there have been horrendous abuses by security forces in the vicinity of your operations in Angola, you know, to an international audience, and would you like to respond? And all of them did respond. The interesting thing when you invite five companies at once to respond on the same issue is obviously you can compare and contrast the responses. And you can see they're all available on our website, some going more directly to address the issue than others. I think NDM are going the furthest. Odebrecht was interesting in that Rafael Marquez said he'd met with people from the company on the ground who acknowledged that this was occurring, but their public response from headquarters in Brazil, where they're based, actually denied the allegations and said, you know, we don't think they're occurring, and focused very much on its community development issues in the projects in the area, which are extremely important, but I think it's just a reminder that I think there's increasing expectations from companies that they are responding directly to issues that are raised about their conduct. This was a recent article, sadly just from quite recently, so indicating that the problem is still there. I think artisanal diamond mining in the area has decreased both because of the financial downturn, so less demand, and also because of diamonds miners being moved out of the area. But even so, similar abuses are still going on in northeast Angola, which is another case similar to Zimbabwe, which raises questions about the effectiveness of the Kimberley process. I know that there was a presenter earlier today who talked about the polishing industry in Surat in particular in India, where sometimes there have been concerns raised about working conditions. And obviously the situation varies very much from factory to factory, company to company. But it's another part of diamond companies' impacts on human rights to sort of bear in mind in terms of looking at the full spectrum of human rights. So this was a case in Gujarat when a diamond worker was killed by a security guard in the process of protesting unsafe working conditions and poor pay in that area. So there's just a few of the issues. seems like many, and it's interesting how, you know, the diamond industry, by the very nature of where diamonds are and how they are mined, inevitably are faced with lots of human rights challenges. So it doesn't necessarily mean that diamond companies have a worse human rights record or a worse, you know, on human rights issues than some in other sectors, but it does mean that the issues you're confronting are extremely difficult and challenging. And I suppose the key is to say, given that situation, the aim is to avoid exacerbating difficult human rights situations in any way is the first step, and then if there are opportunities to actually promote development and improve human rights situations on the ground, obviously doing that as well. I know that Michael Conroy's presentation will talk more about Kimberley, so I won't talk at length about that. The NGO Partnership Africa Canada, which was very instrumental in developing Kimberley in the first place, has issued reports when they call for various measures that would help make it more effective, including not just focusing on conflict diamonds quite narrowly, but also looking at human rights abuses, which would capture issues like what's going on in Angola at the moment, having a more effective external monitoring process, and reforming the way the governance system of the Kimberley process, which is currently very much based on consensus, unanimous consensus, which means that sometimes decisions are made too slowly in situations when faster decision making is needed. Some of you may be aware of the UN Special Representative on Business and Human Rights. He, I think it was around 2005, he started his mandate, which arose from a debate when a document called the UN Norms was developed by a body at the UN, which in a sense was trying to apply international human rights law directly on companies. And obviously that led to a lot of resistance from companies. And on the other side, you had the human rights NGOs saying that they loved the norms and they wanted them turned into a treaty tomorrow. So there was this back and forth with governments in the middle saying, what do we do about this? And the outcome was the appointment of John Ruggie as the UN Special Representative, whose mandate sort of over the last few years has been to clarify what the expectations of business are for human rights issues and then to come up with recommendations. So he's developed a three-pronged framework, which I'll describe in a minute, and is currently developing under that framework guiding principles on business and human rights, which will be launched in draft form in November with a view to the Human Rights Council, governments of the Human Rights Council, and ideally adopting them at their next session next May. And people who want more information on this, it's all on our homepage. There's a portal of information about his work, including commentaries on his work by others that you can access there. So the framework has three pillars. The first is the state's duty to protect human rights, including protecting civilians from abuses by third parties, which include companies. And then you have the corporate responsibility, he calls it, to respect human rights. So rather than a duty sort of enshrined under international law, he's saying it's a responsibility to respect. But while it's not directly relevant, directly enshrined in international law, he says it's become an internationally accepted norm that there is an expectation that companies respect human rights. It's also in lots of voluntary documents, such as the OECD guidelines on multinational enterprises, etc. So it's sort of written there. And the UN Human Rights Council, when they accepted his framework last year, essentially endorsed that idea. And then the third pillar is access to remedy. So saying, okay, we're never going to prevent all human rights abuses relating to the private sector, so we need access to remedy for when they do occur. Just a few illustrations of how the state duty to protect sort of plays out in practice just from recent developments. So, for example, in the USA, the recent reform of the financial regulation of financial regulations included two interesting provisions relating to human rights, one that required companies in the oil, gas, and coal sector who are licensed under the Securities and Exchange Commission to disclose what they pay to governments for their oil and gas, for their natural resources, which a lot of NGOs have been calling for a long time, is this revenue transparency, so that citizens of a country can then hold their governments more accountable as to how those governments are spending that revenue. And then the other was a requirement that companies that are buying coltan and other rare minerals disclose whether they're sourcing them from Democratic Republic of Congo and neighboring countries or not, again, with a view to try and increase supply chain transparency. Interesting, in our update yesterday, we had another new development in that area where 11 African states have also made a similar commitment that's going to increase transparency for so-called conflict minerals. The Swiss government just recently has launched some guidelines on private security companies and human rights that were developed in a joint initiative with input from the US and the UK governments, from NGOs and from the industry. And I understand in November, 20 private security companies are going to sign up to those principles. And that obviously was prompted by issues such as concerns raised about Blackwater's operations in Iraq when civilians were killed, leading to lots of questions about the accountability of the private security sector. And then in India, some of you may be aware of a current reform of the mining law that's going on, with a view to looking at mining companies' impacts on local communities, questioning whether companies should give a proportion of their profit to those communities for development, looking at environmental impacts and questions of displacement, how companies deal with displaced people, which, as India, you know, develops so quickly, is becoming a real challenge there. Okay, so that was the first, the sort of state, steps by states. In terms of the corporate responsibility to respect human rights, John Ruggie's framework has set out four key components of that, if you like. First step being a policy statement saying companies should actually state publicly that they're committed to uphold international human rights standards. We have a running list accessible on our website where you can link through to company human rights policy statements. I think there's around 272 on there at the moment. And we always welcome any company that has one that isn't on our list yet to please get in touch. I know that De Beers and Signet, for example, are two companies within the diamond industry that have policies that are on that list. There's a quote. We also have commentaries on why a company should adopt a human rights policy. And Wambui Kamathi from the Kenyan Human Rights Commission has said, you know, it's a call to action. So the policy itself is great, but isn't enough. It's then a call to action within the company to say, how do we go about implementing this policy? The ideal situation wouldn't be what happened when our director called up a company, admittedly quite a while ago, so I'm sure things have changed, and said, oh, I hear that you've adopted a human rights policy statement. Fabulous. You know, we'd like to put it on our website. And so the person he spoke with said, oh, I think the woman who deals with that isn't in the office today. And, you know, he said, is there anyone else within the company who could tell me about this policy? And nobody could. So I think that was an example in how, you know, policies shouldn't be developed and just sit there. They're actually active instruments. Times have changed a bit since then. The second is impact assessment. And I'm sure we're going to see a trend over future years, just as how companies often do environmental impacts now as a part of course, are going to start doing human rights impact assessments and looking at the full range of their impacts on local communities and human rights more broadly. This is a guide developed by the International Finance Corporation with the International Business Leaders Forum, based in the UK, and the UN Global Compact, with the idea of helping companies go through that process. Again, we have sections on our website that highlight some other companies that have done these, as Gold Corp has done one, BP in Indonesia. And then, of course, it's integrating human rights commitments throughout the company's operations. We have a portal on our site that provides tool and guidance to that effect, organized in various ways. So there's a sector-specific guidance section you can go in, and there's a section on the diamond industry, so you can see what industry associations, what the UN and what NGOs are recommending in practical terms companies do. So that's accessible on our site as well. I think a key part of the implementation is also a question of corporate culture, and it's quite telling that BP, in fact, was one of the companies that had maybe one of the best human rights policies in the industry, and a detailed sort of 30-page guidance note for management on human rights issues. But then, you know, the Texas oil refinery explosion, and then the recent spill in the Gulf is a real reminder that, you know, having the nice policies on paper is one thing, but they really, you need a sort of corporate culture way of doing business that actually puts those commitments into practice throughout the company. Because, you know, BP was often cited in addition for the reporting and the policies for its good practice in Indonesia. So there was a certain compartmentalizing going throughout the company. And then the fourth is tracking and reporting on performance. Again, you know, environmental reporting is now part of the course for a lot of companies. More and more companies are reporting on their human rights impacts as well. And there's guidance, such as this guidance by the Global Reporting Initiative, coming out to help companies do that. Mary Robinson, the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, who chairs our international advisory network and is very engaged on business and human rights issues, has often said it's a shame that so few governments actually require companies registered there to report on human rights issues. There's just a handful of them, and that's something that she'd like to see governments doing more of, is actually making it a requirement that companies report on their human rights issues. Third pillar, so your state duty to protect, corporate responsibility to respect, and then access to remedies, which is two-pronged. There's non-judicial remedies, so that could be just a complaints system within a company, or it could be a much bigger process. There's one at the OECD, for example, whereby civil society organizations or impacted people can bring a complaint to national contact points of the OECD, who then look into those and come out with recommendations. And this is a Bases Wiki. It's an interactive wiki, as the name implies, where people upload information about these types of complaint mechanisms and how they're working in different parts of the world. Of course, when that... And I think the idea with these complaints mechanisms, obviously, is that to deal with it as locally and as quickly as possible before it escalates to the international level, or before it becomes a really major conflict, or before litigation arises. This is another portal on our website, Legal Accountability Portal, where we profile human rights lawsuits that have been brought against companies for alleged human rights abuses. You may have seen recently there was a ruling in the case against Shell for abuses in Nigeria that was brought under the Alien Tort Claims Act here in the United States, that had been being used to bring cases against companies for abuses they committed overseas. And that ruling implied, and it's likely to stay that way for a while, that the Alien Tort Claims Act can't be applied directly to corporations, that international human rights law can't be applied directly to corporations. Having said that, there are ways in which that ruling might be challenged, and at the same time, it's certainly not the death knell for human rights lawsuits against companies. And one thing that we're focused on here is highlighting cases that are brought in national jurisdictions, so for example in the South African courts and the Indian courts, featuring how those different cases have been brought and what the various stages of them have been. We also feature commentaries on legal accountability down there, and one of them is by Michael Smith, who was until very recently a partner at Clifford Chance Law Firm. And he says in it, there was a time when business lawyers did not need to know a great deal about human rights law. That's no longer the case. Business law and policy norms are evolving in a way that increases the exposure of corporates in relation to human rights infractions. This is now a key boardroom issue. And then underneath all of this, involving, you know, companies and governments and multi-stakeholder initiatives, when a particular issue arises and then the various parties involved say, okay, you know, we need to get together and deal with this collaboratively. A few relating to the diamond industry that I'm sure you all know of. And in fact, this one, the Responsible Jewellery Council, that's less a multi-stakeholder initiative, more a industry initiative. Now has approximately 250 member companies from the diamond and gold jewellery sector, which commit to the Responsible Jewellery Council principles and also to be audited against those principles by third parties. And while it's an industry initiative, it does have an advisory board, I think I'm right, of people made up from NGOs and elsewhere who advise on the standards and how they're implemented. And then the Diamond Development Initiative was developed in some ways as a sort of next step after Kimberley, saying, okay, conflict diamonds are not under control, but big steps have been made to combat the problem of conflict diamonds, but we still have the issue of artisanal mining, thousands of them around the world who often work in very poor conditions and whereby the industry really is not contributing to the development of the places where they're operating. So that brings together NGOs, governments, and the private sector to address their problems. They say we envisage development diamonds as diamonds that are produced responsibly, safely, with respect of human and communities' rights, in conflict-free zones, and with benefits to communities and payments of fair prices to the miners. Another is the Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance, which is aiming to come up with an independent third-party assurance system that would assure mines operate in a socially and environmentally responsible manner. This is Mike Posner, who was the founder of a very respected human rights organization here in the US called Human Rights First, who's now Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights with the Obama administration. And he was very involved in drawing up the Fair Labor Association, which was one of the first multi-stakeholder initiatives, if you like, that brought together apparel companies looking at, you know, sweatshop or working conditions or poor working conditions in their supply chains with members of non-governmental organizations as well, so companies and NGOs. Then also with the Voluntary Principles on Security and Human Rights that looked at the security measures taken by extractive companies. And then most recently with one that's been in the media quite a bit, on the Global Network Initiative, which is internet companies dealing with the issue of freedom of expression in countries like China. Yahoo, Microsoft, Google, etc., saying how do we operate in those countries without infringing freedom of expression or of information. And this is just a quote about some of the key aspects of multi-stakeholder initiatives that he has found and necessary in order to make them work properly and actually make a difference on the ground. To succeed, you must set a high but not impossible bar, develop concrete standards, serious accountability or enforcement structures, include a system of public transparency. And for all this to happen, companies must be ready to yield some control. And then finally, my last slide, is something that has come up in the work of the UN representative, John Ruggie, is this shift from naming and shaming, so when companies were exposed for abuses and shame for it, to... And I actually wrote that the wrong way around. I think knowing and showing works better, to knowing and showing, or in other words, from sort of exposure to disclosure. And I'd say we're sort of at the beginning of this trend. It's only going to grow, but whereby companies are paying much more attention to knowing, being informed about what people are saying about their conduct on the ground, taking action on that, and then demonstrating as authentically as possible what they're doing about it. And I think key in the showing element is that authenticity is, almost better no information than misleading information. There's a real incentive to provide verifiable communications about the company's what it's doing on human rights. Part of all of this process as well is obviously listening to diverse perspectives, just as is being done today at this conference. So on this note, I'd like to turn on to the next speaker. But thank you very much. I can email if anyone wants to call.